Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so let us begin. I just want to finish up with Rav Charlap, and then we're going to move into Rav Aaron Cutler. Just a couple of things from last class. here I have the article about koshering teeth, if anyone's interested, from a Rabbi Yehuda Spitz. And he explains why you don't need to kosher your teeth. Dentures are like regular teeth, which are highly not absorbent. Most people don't eat food when it's piping hot. And then he gives another reason or two. I also want to say that I misspoke at the end of last class, sort of, when I was asked by, I think it was Yisrael, a question, and I said that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook is was a typical Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva. What? I have to clarify that. Merkaz HaRav is basically a typical Lithuanian yeshiva, however, it's Zionist. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda, it's incorrect what I said that he's a typical Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, because although philosophically he is, and that's what he wanted his yeshiva, he's not a typical Rosh Yeshiva in the sense that he didn't give a shiur in Gemara. He's more in line with, let's say, Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel. That's when you speak in terms. So Merkaz itself always had great Talmudic scholars as the Rosh Yeshiva, but he, although he was the Rosh Yeshiva, and the Alter was not a Rosh Yeshiva, even though he really was the head of the Yeshiva, he never called himself Rosh Yeshiva because he didn't give a Gemara Shir. This now, why didn't Ritzi Yehuda spoke on Emunah, as they called it. I'm not going to call it Musar, Hashkafa, whatever. They now his students say that he could have given a Gemara Shir, and if you look at his notes, actually Rav Zevin mentions this. If you look at his notes to Rav Cook, his father's responsa, you see his great Talmudic learning. So they claim that he could have given it, but he thought the generation needed emunah. I don't know if that's true. I mean, he definitely was a Talmudic scholar, but to say that he's at the level to give shiurim of a Rosh Yeshiva, I don't know if that's the case, but he did not give. So, in fact, I don't know if there's any other Rosh Yeshiva in modern times who did not give Shiurim in Talmud, other than Rav Tzvi And after Rav Tzvi Yehuda's passing, of course, then Rav Avraham Shapiro takes over. Then it becomes a standard sort of yeshiva with the Rosh Yeshiva giving shiur. Okay, everyone, let's now. I'm sorry about the voice. But let us finish up with Rav Charlap. Just a few more things I want to do. I'm sure many people listening, either live or on tape, also know what it's been like in the last few days in the New York area. So please bear with me. Hope I'll be able to make it. Just a few more things of Rav Charlap I think you'll find of interest in Heid Harim. In the new edition, it's on page 38 and 39. Rav Tzvi Yehuda writes to, sorry, Rav Charlap writes to Rav Tzvi Yehuda, and he mentions the Ruach. What is the Ruach? In the note, it explains what's going on here. And then he says to him that this event, in all its details, should be written down. The story is as follows, and Ritzvi Yehuda told it at length in another place, actually in his letters, Tzemach Tzvi. The story was an actual story of a dibbuk. So if you're going to say, well, Ritzvi Yehuda's, like I just said, he's like a Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, what's he doing speaking about a dibbuk? The fact that you're a Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva has nothing to do with not believing in dibbukim. In a dibbuk, the famous one we spoke about last semester is Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. The Chafetz Chaim believed in it, apparently, and many others. And the story, I don't need to go into the whole details, but it's a story about how a Sephardic person had a dibbuk in him, and only Rav Kook was able to get the dibbuk out. And Rav Kook demanded that the dibbuk leave through the finger or the toe. And look, it's a whole story here. I don't not need to go through the whole story of it, but it's a famous story in certain circles of the Dybbuk that Rav Kook was able to bring out of a person. And in all these cases, there's something strange. For example, in this case, the Dybbuk spoke Hebrew, even though the individual, the Sephardic individual, did not know Hebrew. So it wasn't him speaking, it was the Dybbuk speaking. I am actually going to be publishing a letter from a German rabbi to Agnon, in which he tells him a whole story about a Dybbuk. An amazing story, and I'm not sure how to explain these things if you don't believe in the Dybbuk, but stay tuned for that. The problem is, it was supposed to be in an article. This Hasidic journal asked me, if you can believe it, a Hasidic journal asked me to contribute. And I sent him this since I thought it would be great. And they said, well, they'll publish it, but they want to censor one section of it. And I refused. And what they wanted to censor is because the Dybbuk starts speaking about a certain individual who apparently it must be a Rebbe. They said that if you investigate it, you could find out that it's a Hasidic Rebbe from Galicia, and they didn't want to include this. But Moshe from Lakewood mentions that Reb Nosson Kamenetsky says there were others who said the Chafetz Chaim suggested it was just mental illness. He did more than that. We spoke about this last semester. He said that he cited from someone who claimed that Reb Elchanan Wasserman was naive to actually believe this. So I spoke all about the Dybbuk last semester, and I mentioned that the Dybbuk is not included, even though it's perhaps the most famous event in Reb Elchanan Wasserman's life, and it's found in the Hebrew biography. In the Art Scroll English biography, they've removed everything about the Dybbuk. A couple other things, just quickly in Razili, which is the last volume here that we spoke about of Rav Charlap, on page 57, he speaks about the obligation to love the simple people. Chovat ahava la'anashim ha'pshutim. It's also, I think, significant because usually you don't think of these elite type of personalities in speaking about the need to love the simple person. On page 92, he speaks about what mahu gadlut, what is gadlut, and if you read it and then and look at who Rav Kook was in his eyes, it'll make sense. On page 96, he speaks about the siman of gadlut. You judge a gadol by chidush, the fact that he's able to come up with new ideas. On page 150, he speaks about the madrega, the level of the gra and of the Baal Shem Tov. Obviously, the gra is higher than the Baal Shem Tov, but he speaks about that. And he also speaks about the problems with Chassidut, that in Chassidut, they went from Emunat Chachamim to Emunat Chacham. And the focus was on the one Chacham, and he shows the problem with that. A couple other things. He asks on page 274, how come we don't have people with Ruach HaKodesh today? And he says, because even the religious people, the Yoreim and the Charedim, they are kofrim in Ruach HaKodesh. They don't believe it. They don't believe that people today could have Ruach HaKodesh. And therefore, because of that, the generation is not worthy of it. He says the kfira is doche the Ruach HaKodesh from the world. I don't think he's referring to the Hasidic figures. They still believe it. But the Lithuanians are too cynical, maybe. And they don't accept it as a reality, and therefore it can't exist. Similar sort of stuff that we've been seeing. 345. He says he explains how a liar cannot daven properly, because he can't speak the truth, and even if he wants to speak the truth, he's such a liar, it's full of sheker. So with that, we say goodbye to the Maamar Rome. There is another meme I roam on Pirkei on Shmona Prakim of the Rambam. I'm not going to spend the time looking at it, although I have it here. It's interesting. I mean, he has to deal with the golden mean of the Rambam. He even explains that the golden mean is an example of taking maybe ideas that we see them in the non-Jewish sources and literally converting them through Torah to Jewish sources. He speaks about the reasons of the commandments for the Rambam, how don't think that these are the actual reasons, that these are just reasons that enable us to connect. Nothing else really I want to talk about. And the last thing I want to mention before we move on to Rav Aaron Cutler, and again, I apologize if I really sound bad. The last thing I want to mention is a couple of his reflections on the Holocaust. While I'm taking out my paper here, I want to thank Moshe from Lakewood. At the end of last class, he mentioned Rav Zelig Tarshish of Kelm. You can look for him a little bit online and you'll see stuff about him. He is a sort of a figure, one of these Rav Charlap type of Lithuanian type of tzaddikim who would do hitbodedut, to go out into the fields, that sort of thing. I mentioned last class, do we have any other figures of Rav Charlap? So thank you, Moshe. Okay, the only thing I want to call you, he has a book, it's called Imrei Noam. You could see it on HebrewBooks.org. And the subtitle is Divrei Nichumim, Words of Comfort and Chizuk and Encouragement out to the Jewish people. Why do they need encouragement and all that? Well, because after the Holocaust, the question is, are you going to be encouraged by, and are you going to find Chizuk by what he says? He says, let me just read you a couple of examples so you'll see what I'm talking about. I mean, the very fact that he's going to try to explain the Holocaust, or at least give some justification, I don't know if that's the right word, is already going to be problematic. It's going to be problematic for modern people. It's going to be problematic for many traditionalists for whom this is regarded as the ultimate in suffering that can't be explained. So listen to what he says. On page 9, speaks about obviously how awesome, awesomely terrible the Holocaust was. But he says all these yisurim, all these problems and difficulties and pain that the Jews went through were only mezakekenu, to purify us. Just like pure silver and gold, so that we could be ready, we could be purified to dwell in the land of Israel. And that's why there was such terrible destruction, because the time had come, Shebodkim Kol Echad Yisrael, every member of the Jewish people was to be investigated. Imhu ra'oi la'alot l'darga kazo. Whether he was worthy of reaching this level. So, in other words, it's the Jew, there's a process here of elimination. I don't know what to call it. And then he says, page 10, we can't question anything that happened in the Holocaust. Not at all. Rather, we were together with the Tsar of the Shechina. He develops this Kabbalistic idea here that God's divine presence, the Shechina, is also in pain. And he says that we have no way of imagining how much the Shechina was in pain. It's, again, if you're not a Kabbalist, it's hard to grasp this concept. But he says, the Shechina was in pain. And just like we don't understand how great the Shechina's pain was, we need to put aside our pain and declare in a loud voice, Ki anu smechim bi yisurim eleh. We are happy with these with this pain that we've suffered. We're prepared to die al Kiddush Hashem, and we will not abandon our faith. We will become stronger, and we'll accept what God gives us. And even if it was the case, he says, that we would receive benefit, reward for doing an aveira, and we get punished for doing a mitzvah, we still would do the mitzvah even if we'd be punished, because we want to be follow God's way. But the idea that of the Tsar of the Shechina is, I think, significant, and also the idea that we're Semechim b'Yisurim, that we're glad, we're joyous that we've been punished. Easier said than done. And I don't even know if that's anything to be expected, or if that's, I mean, you look at all the other people who write on the Holocaust, the people who survived the Holocaust, who saw terrible things. I don't recall any of them. We have many survivors, many great rabbis who wrote memoirs. I can't recall any of them writing that that we should that would declare that we rejoice at the pain. Even though the Talmud says you're supposed to rejoice at the difficult things, just like you are at the positive things. It's always easier said than done. And I don't know of anyone else, anyone who lived through it, certainly, who said that we suffer terribly, but we rejoice from the way God suffered. On the contrary, they say that how terrible it was, and we can't understand it, but God must have had his reasons. So this is not the sort of thing that I think Holocaust survivors could appreciate or would appreciate. And he goes on page 17, speaking about the value of suffering. It is a traditional Jewish value. It's not just a Christian value. Christians speak in terms of the suffering. We have it as well. And that this is what this is what enables us to be the Mamleches Kohanim, the Goy Kadosh. And what does Aaron do after his suffering? It says, "Vayidom Aaron." Aaron was silent, and that's what we have to be. We have to be silent and just accept everything. And one more thing, on page 22, he says, this is how he ends. We must let the entire world know, Libenu Shalem Hashem, that we don't have any claims against God. We've accepted everything. And the Yisurim Hagdolim, Einam Ela Yisurim Shalava. All the terrible things we've suffered, they are Yisurim Shalava. Pain from out of love. This is a Talmudic idea that sometimes God will punish you to reward you out of love. He'll punish you so you can have the world to come. He'll punish you so you don't suffer worse in this world. The Rambam rejects this idea of Yisurim Shalava. He says that this is a view, but we don't accept it. But this is a very traditional view also, and it's a way to explain suffering. And Rav Charap adopts it. And he says God is testing us to see that if we love him with all our heart. And if we do, then everything he says will be set right. And this is Rav Charap really believed that the Holocaust was the final test, the final challenge. And it's like a reward after the terrible pain that God has given us the land of Israel, and now we've moved into the final arena. Rav Tzvi Yehuda also has an eschatology, has a theodicy. He doesn't say what the Rav Charap says. He speaks about how, as we saw, the land of Israel, that the Jews of Europe were so tied to the Galut. The only way to remove and destroy this Gullus mentality of the Jews was by cutting it out. And therefore, God had to do something which was, almost, I don't know if you can use these words, but to say very cruel, or appears cruel. He had to do a terrible thing. Cut out so much of the Jewish people because that was the only way to destroy this Gullus mentality. The response to this, obviously, was, well, if God is, can do anything, couldn't God have found an easier way of destroying the Gaullist mentality than having all these Jews and all these a million children killed? The problem with all this theodicy is, and I think Yitz Greenberg said it very well. He said about theodicy, he was talking about, I think, why innocents suffer. Not in terms of the na internet, not in terms of like millions of people, but even just one. If you're theodicy, if you're not comfortable, let's say you have a theodicy explaining why good people suffer. If you're not comfortable in saying this to a mother sitting by the side of her child, suffering terribly from cancer, dying, if you don't feel comfortable saying it to the mother, then it's not worth anything. In other words, getting up in an academic conference or writing it and give all these reasons that suffering is ennobling, suffering makes us better people, whatever you're going to say, suffering this, suffering that. If you can't say it to a parent whose child is literally dying in front of them, then it's best it shouldn't be said at all. So whether your judgment about Rav Charlap's theodicy is falls into that, I'll let you judge. But unlike Rav Soloveitchik, who said that we can't explain this, and we're not supposed to explain it, and the lesson of the Book of Eov, Job, is supposed to be silence, and that these are not the things we're supposed to understand. Our history has many people giving theodicies. They Rav Soloveitchik was onto something here, because although everyone tries to explain things, the lesson of the Book of Eov is precisely you're not supposed to explain. And when Eov's friends try to explain, God gets angry at them. And the lesson of the Book of Eov is that there is an explanation, it's but humans can't appreciate it. When God appears out of the whirlwind, he compares it to, I mean, try to explain nuclear physics to your dog. I mean, it's you can't do it. And we're humans, we're puny. I mean, there's a huge universe here. We can't understand, why things happen, but we don't have to understand. The lesson is that we just have to know that God is there for us, and we don't understand, and we're not meant to understand. And Rav Soloveitchik thought that that was the only pious answer. There are reasons, but we are not equipped to understand these reasons, and we shouldn't even attempt to understand them, because that's not what it's like. If a parent, if a parent is doing something that's going to hurt the baby for the baby's own good, pulling out a with a tweezers, a nail or something, the child will recognize, hopefully, that the parent is doing it for the good. So with that, Moshe asked where the Rambam is. The Rambam is in the Mor Nevuchim, where he mentions that there is such a concept of Yisurim Shel Ahava, but this is not the mainstream, he thinks. Whenever the Rambam is confronted with views among the sages that he doesn't want to accept, he says this isn't the mainstream view. He says this about astrology. He says this about other examples as well. So with that, we end Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. If there are any final questions, I'm happy to take them. If not, we're going to move right into Rav Aaron Cutler. If you knew how difficult it is for me to do this, but I'm looking at the clock. I still have at least a half hour. This is not good, but hopefully it'll give me some strength. So I see no questions. So then we will move on. I hope that you found Rabbi Charlap of interest. And now we move on to an individual who, as I said last class, is of really enormous significance. And a significance that continues to grow, a significance that every one of us is influenced, both because we come into contact here in America, that is. If you come into contact with people influenced by Rav Aaron Cutler, you come into contact with the Kiruv Kollels, with the Yeshiva. If you're in Lakewood, as we have someone, I mean, Lakewood today is so much more than the Yeshiva. It's a whole city of Orthodox Jews, of Torah, of everything. But it all comes, the origin from the Yeshiva. And we'll speak about the origin of the Yeshiva. We'll talk about why Lakewood. I think you'll find interesting where I work in Scranton. I mean, the great Lakewood influence. So, but even before you get to Lakewood, there's an interesting story. And so let us begin with Ravan Cutler. There's even some academic articles on Ravan Cutler, which I'll share with you, including in the new book that came out on the Gedolim that I've spoken about. Okay, no more to introduce. Ravan Cutler, 1891 to 1962. Already you see that he died young, 71 years old. And then he achieved, as we'll see, a great deal. Ravaron, as we'll see very soon, was influential even before coming to the United States. He already in Europe was known as an important Rosh Yeshiva, even though he was not old then, he was middle-aged. But his impact really is a post-war impact today. In other words, if the Holocaust never happened and everything remained in Europe, he would have been a Rosh Yeshiva. But you can't speak in terms of the influence until after World War II. And we'll see what it was about America that enabled him to step in to a certain role. I believe that Ravaron Cutler is one of the three most important rabbinic figures in the United States in the post-war World War II years. One is Rav Soloveitchik, because of his great influence. Posthumous influence, even more than during his lifetime, I think. Another is Rav Aaron Cutler, the whole yeshiva movement in America, and to a certain extent, you can argue it's had influence in Israel as well, but mostly in America. And not just America, North America, Europe as well, but in particular, America. I don't know how much the serious influence there is in Israel, but in America. And of course, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, his influence during his lifetime, and it continues posthumously. The complexion of Lithuanian style orthodoxy, the yeshiva world in America, for good or for bad, is in large measure due to his influence and the institution he developed, the Lakewood Yeshiva and the whole yeshiva world. If you take Rav Aaron out of the picture, the Haredi movement in America turns out entirely different. If you look in the 1940s, 1950s, 60s even, you had Haredi, your so-called Haredi yeshivas. You had Torah Das, you had Chaim Berlin. And the standard there was a much more moderate standard. Going to university at night was standard. Everyone did that. There was no expectation to of avoiding university in its entirety. There even was a plan, as we'll see, to open up an American Jewish university. There was just a more liberal perspective. When I say liberal, this isn't YU. This was opposition to YU. However, not along the lines of Lakewood and the Ner Yisrael. That opened up also already before the war. Before, I forget the year actually, right around that time. You had a yeshiva in Cleveland, and things changed, as we'll see. Now, what's really interesting, and we'll also see, is the post-war influence after Rav Aaron's death. And he has to be given the credit for it because what he set in motion. So let's begin with the biography. Okay, it's getting hard for me here. With your and I'm getting private texts to tell me that I'm not sounding very good, and it is very difficult. So I'm thinking then, why don't we, if it's not too difficult for you, and if you don't feel like you came on and it was too hard, if you don't feel like it's going to be too big a disappointment. How about we end now? We end with Rav Charlap. I know we only went a half hour, but if I tell you that this is very difficult for me, maybe you'll appreciate it. You'll understand. God willing, we'll pick up. I don't want to completely ruin my voice on Pesach. I'm supposed to be speaking, We'll pick up after Pesach, if anyone's typing in, I can respond. But for me to speak, it's becoming hard, really hard. This is like the 174th class. I don't know if we've ever had a class where I haven't been able to finish in 174 times. So I guess sometimes it happens. I do want to thank you all, the ones who are with us, all the ones who've been listening and have been emailing me, some of you on an almost weekly basis with questions or comments. Thank you all. I wish you all also a good Chag Kasher Sameach, and we'll pick up again later. And good night, everyone. And again, I'm really sorry. You believe me, you all know me now. You know that if I could stay with you, I'd stay with you not just to 10, I'd stay with you to 10:15, 10:30. But it's just unfortunately just too much today. So good night, everyone, and thank you always for coming on for the show.